Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 242, I am joined by Drs. Sarah Reed and Sriji Patel for a group discussion of common surgical complications and how to manage them. This was at the request of listeners who wanted to hear more discussion of actually how to manage the complications and not just some of the great conversation we had about how to counsel and go through a patient during the complication in the postoperative period. We're going to talk about what to do during surgery, and we kind of did it in quick-hitting fashion. We're going to spend just 2 minutes for topic. There's going to be 10 complications we're going to talk about. If you like this topic, if you want to hear more similar episodes, we're happy to do this again. We recorded this back a while ago and have been saving this to release. This ties in nicely to what I'm going to talk about next, which is the VBS Part 2 of the online series, which is a Zoom meeting that you can register for by clicking on the link in the episode description. Registration is free, and some of the topics that will be covered in this meeting, the biggest will be the complication session, which will be showing video complications submitted by real retinal surgeons, and then a panel discussion of how to manage those complications in real time. So that dovetails really nicely with what we're talking about here in this episode. You can claim CME for this episode all and prior podcast episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. That link is also in the episode description. You can see a list of financial disclosures for the contributors in the episode description. And as always, stay tuned. We just released VBS Part 1, the audio format. If you liked it, and if you like Part 2, if you're not able to make the meeting, you want to hear Part 2 in audio, just let us know, and we can coordinate to have Part 2 released as well as a podcast. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retina colleagues. First in alphabetical order, Dr. Sriji Patel from Nashville, Tennessee, Vanderbilt University. Sriji, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Next, Dr. Sarah Reed from Honolulu, Hawaii. Sarah, welcome. I'm enjoying these. The telehealth has had many advantages, but one of the things it has is included the Sarah Reed proportion of this podcast, which is a win for everyone.
Thanks so much for having me, Jay.
So we're going to talk about these theoretical things that never happen called complications. I'm just kidding. We're going to talk about complications. And this is an idea from a couple of listeners that brought up this idea. We talked about complications in terms of counseling. It's a little harder to talk about complications in an audio format sometimes. If a picture's worth 1,000 words, a video's worth 1,000,000 words when it comes to complications. But people have been keen to hear about how to manage these complications, even in an audio format. So let's go for it, and we're going to try this. And if people like this, we can come back and do a series on other sort of specific surgical scenarios or buckles or other sort of complications we'll see. So I have, Letterman style, the top 10 complications that we're going to discuss regarding vitrectomy. And to make this extra speedy, because we all have places to go, I am going to set a timer on my phone, and we're going to do 2 minutes per complication to make this extra speedy. And I'm going to present each of you with a complication, and you have a minute to tell me what you would do. And we're going to go from the start of the case to the end of the case. You guys good with the rules?
Love it.
Sounds good.
You're already, if you said no, Sriji, you're already outvoted, so it's too late. Okay, so number one, Sarah Reed, you get to go first. Ladies first. Infusion is in the suprachoroidal space. You note it at the start of the case. What do you do?
So you mean you put in the infusion and it's already in the suprachoroidal space?
Yep.
So you weren't able to get it.
You start the case, you start vitrectomy, and you're like, oh my God, there's a choroidal developing.
So I would say two things. First is in cases where it's a chronic RD, there's already choroidals. A lot of times I'll use a 6-millimeter infusion or I'll use an AC maintainer. So if I'm unable to move the infusion into the vitreous cavity, then I'll try to use one of those two options. If it was a misplaced trocar or the trocar moved during depression or with the speculum, then I'll try to move the infusion into one of the superior two trocar ports. One of the options that you can try to do is if you put it through one of the superior ports, confirm it's in the vitreous cavity, then you can bump the pressure up and actually drain the choroidal out through the trocar that's in the suprachoroidal space. That can work, and it's sort of fancy. It's been published before. Otherwise, the most important thing with any of these complications is making sure you identify them early and act early. So making sure you stop your infusion and then get your infusion into the correct place is the most important part of the step.
That was good. Srizi, 20-second rebuttal or addition.
Nope, I agree completely. Jay, you and I are, when we operate with fellows, I'll say this, if anyone's operating with fellows out there, I spend a good amount of my mental energy making sure that infusion is where we left it.
Good.
And out of prevention.
Number two, Srizi, you're operating with your fellow and they tickle the lens. How do you decide when lens touch needs to be addressed during the case with a lensectomy versus leaving the lens as it is and observing postoperatively? Crystalline lens, just for the listeners, not IOL.
Sure. So definitely have seen this before. What I'll say is if the lens has been iatrogenically removed, then at that point, I think you're obligated to do a lensectomy right then and there. If it's just a touch and it's peripheral and it's not obstructing the view to do the surgery, then I'll usually leave it and I'll monitor postoperatively to see if the cataract is progressing. I've actually seen at times it just kind of stays a peripheral area where you can see the vitrector or the light pipe touch than you would expect after a vitrectomy. So these can be safely observed, assuming that it doesn't rapidly progress during surgery and block your view.
Sarah, anything else to add?
No, I agree completely. If you sort of knock the back of the lens capsule, but the capsule is not violated, then there's a good chance you can just leave it during the case. But I do think exactly the same point. If you are starting to lose the view, just like anything, it's important to make a decision early as opposed to trying to fight view of view that's getting incredibly worse. Your first job is to protect the retina. If you have to take the lens to do that, you have to.
And do you maintain the anterior capsule if you decide to take it?
Yes.
Srizi, you do the same, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I always try to, yes.
I think that's a good place, because we have a little extra time here because you did such a good job. I think it's a good place to kind of stop and think about whether or not you want to take it. And again, you talked about the capsular violation. It's happened a couple times to me that I've had to take it, but both times I kind of stopped for a minute, kind of looked at it, thought about it. But I think the problem is I remember as a fellow, we had a couple cases where, you know, we thought it was violated. We decided to observe, and they get a very rapid cataract and shallowing of the AC and high pressures often in those cases. And then you're taking someone back to the operating room. So neither option is great but I think that's a good way to kind of judge whether you need to do something more. Number three, Dr. Srizi Patel. So fellow or you go to appeal, more likely the fellow, or reduce a PVD. And now you have a large iatrogenic posterior break. What do you do? What's kind of your thought process? When do you treat those? When do you not? Do you continue with your goals for the case? How do you manage that?
So if we assume that it's a break with no fluid, you want to obviously make sure all the vitreous traction has been removed. And then I would generally laser adjust would any other retinal break. And then go about the typical, go about achieving the goals of the case, whether it's a macular hole or whatever. Obviously, if you feel like there's some potential for, you know, there's either a cup of subretinal fluid that's forming or if there's hemorrhage in that area, then I would be a little bit more aggressive. And, you know, I have a low threshold to treat these as a localized retinal detachment, in which case I might do at least a full air fill, if not a smaller, like an SF6 gas bubble, just because once you remove the vitreous without an internal tamponade, the retina can detach quite quickly. You have to have a very low threshold to treat this as you would any other case that had a retinal break.
Sarah, anything to add on top?
I would say sometimes if it's more of a avulsed vessel or like more of a bonk than like a full
bonk
break,
like
then
like
I'll just try to
effect.
Use diathermy. Yeah, it's a technical term. You can almost feel the detractor make a bonk sound. I would say I've also had a few times where I'm lifting the hyoid and I get a break that's actually fairly posterior as the hyoid is coming up. Usually a small break. Those I will also manage at least with laser and a fluid air exchange, because I assume at that point that I'm dealing with a slightly atypical vitreous. And so I'm same thing, a little more conservative with those.
And just one, my little addition to that, the very first time this happened to me as a fellow was in a diabetic with an epiretinal membrane and what seemed to be like just mild non-proliferative disease. But myopes and diabetics can have abnormal hyaloids. And I visibly remember rolling in, putting the cutter up, and doing a pretty quick maneuver to pull the hyaloid off of the nerve towards the nasal side of the nerve. And as that happened, without contacting the retina, with no bonk, just the retina just pulled open. Very similar to as if you had a TRD in a diabetic and you just pulled on something. You would never pull on those fibroblasts and just pop it because a lot of times you get a lot of breaks. I wouldn't say never, but you would not often do that. And this was behaving similarly. So I would just say caution in certain scenarios where the diabetic, especially have a low threshold, the hyaloid might be tighter than you think, even if the retinopathy is not as severe as you think it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Good. Number four. Who's up? I lost count. It's Treji, right? Okay. I can't keep track. This is exciting radio discussing this. number four. Treji, you're going to go. You're doing an air fluid exchange and the IOL frosts, and now you can't see or the fellow can't see. What do you do?
So I've definitely seen this many times before. You can take the soft tip and generally just kind of wipe it clean, and that'll work for a little while.
How long is a little while?
It's something that keeps on persisting, usually less than a minute. And so if it's something that is going to be something that you're going to need to do you have some work that you need to do, either in draining as quickly as you'd like, or there's other things that need to be done, you can put some viscoelastic on the underside of the lens, and that'll usually get you at least 5 to 10 minutes of clarity so that you can kind of complete the portions of the surgery after that. But whenever I do encounter this, I usually try and push the accelerate button a little bit because very quickly it can be very frustrating not being able to see, and we all know that if you start doing things and you can't see, problems can arise.
And before Sarah goes, I would say one of the bigger things is just recognizing it's the IOL, because sometimes I'll see fellows get very frustrated by the view, and they, over time, you have the experience to know it's the IOL frosting, because you can sort of see around the edges when they're past the optic and the periphery of the capsule. But I think sometimes people are just fighting it, not realizing it's a very simple, quick fix, as you said, maybe to buy a view to finish the case. Sarah, any thoughts on frosting?
That's exactly what I do. I windshield wiper with my soft tip. That gets me usually about 2 to 3 minutes, and then I can use Helon. That gets me about 5 to 10 minutes. So depending on how much of the case is left. Also, having a laser with a light on it, usually you can still get your laser done even with a poor view. With that, I've found that you have enough visibility even with some fogging.
Yeah, that's a great point. I would say sometimes your peripheral view is better than your central view because of where it tends to frost. And a lot of times it's frosting because there's a capsulotomy or a YAG capsulotomy. And so sometimes your peripheral laser can be done easily. It's more you're not able to see when you're trying to complete a drain or go to the nerve, for example, at the end of a fluid air exchange. Or take out PFO, for example, which is always kind of a little heartrending when you can't see that you're getting all the PFO out.
Definitely.
Sarah, you start an AFX and all of a sudden you notice that there are choroidals. What do you do? What's happening? What are some possibilities?
So I would say the first thing I'd want to check is to make sure that my infusion's in the right place and that it's not either out of the eye so that I'm not getting hypotenuse choroidals, and then the second that it's not in the choroidal space. I've had it happen before where, for whatever reason, the infusion may not be out of the eye, but it may be bent or occluded with something. And so as I'm doing my fluid air exchange, I'm actually dropping the pressure in the eye and getting some choroidals that way. I actually haven't had it before where there's actually air in the suprachoroidal space causing the choroidal, though my inclination would be to do the same management as if the infusion was in the choroidal, which would be move the infusion to a safer port and then bump the pressure up to see if I can drain it out through that trocar. Otherwise, you know, suprachoroidal air, my guess would be you don't necessarily have to chase it as long as you catch it early and you can still complete the case.
Great points. And I would also add that sometimes I've seen it where when you start that fluid air exchange, if you go too rapidly, even if it's in the correct place, even if it's not bent, there's almost like an airlock effect where the air doesn't quite come in. And so once you bypass fluid, remember when you start the fluid air exchange, the infusion's still running fluid for a little bit before the machine switches it. Or has it's run enough down the line to switch it, and then you get an airlock effect that transient hypotony gives you those choroidals. Sriji, bonus question. You see those choroidals now. Let's say they're hemorrhagic from hypotony. what do you do? Do you do anything differently at that point? Let's say you're doing a detachment and you're going to do laser and if your fluid exchange and close, are you going to do anything differently in terms of your management or your tamponade?
You definitely, you know, we know that these choroidals, they can take up some space, and when they relax, your fill may be less than ideal. So if it's a big one, I would go and drain it. If it's small, but I'm concerned, especially if it's a peripheral detachment, I may putting in a longer acting tamponade or even oil if I'm concerned that the choroidal could progress postoperatively.
Awesome. Number six, 3G. You start doing your fluid air exchange, and all of a sudden there's a big bubble of air under the retina. Why did this happen?
Sure. So there's a few reasons that this could happen. The reasons that I've seen most commonly is that there may be too much residual traction on the retina. The retina will relax, and then air can access the subretinal space. The other obvious reason is if the cannula has gone subretinal or if it's pointing towards an open break and air gets in there during the FAX. So these are the reasons why I've seen it. Air in the subretinal space is definitely problematic. If I see that happening, first thing I usually do is I will go back to a space with the soft tip and then reassess the situation, make sure that my cannula is where it needs to be, and make sure that, you know, I've gotten all the traction off. If not, you may need to be in a situation where you need to do a retinectomy or something like that, just so the retina can relax appropriately.
Terrific. And Sarah, you've seen this. What do you do? Anything different?
So I actually had this happen once as I was peeling peripherally because there was a lot of PVR. I actually managed to lift the retina up above my infusion without realizing it. And so I'd sort of finished most of my vitrectomy portion of the case, but by sort of pulling up on the retina, I popped the infusion into the subretinal space. Same thing as everything else. Then I went to the fluid air exchange. All of a sudden there's bubbles underneath the retina. And I did my favorite trick where I just pop it out and put it underneath into a safer space, and then just continue doing my fluid air exchange, and that air just sort of came out, drained it through the break. So as long as you catch it early, not a big deal, but in this particular case, this wasn't an especially complicated detachment, but because I was doing peripheral peeling, that's where I'd gotten myself into trouble.
That's an amazing case, and to paraphrase, happy cases are all alike, but every unhappy case is unhappy in its own way. Sriji, do you know where that's from? Intermission. I think Sarah knows. That's Anna Karenina, opening line. Anyway, that's your fact of the day. Sarah.
Bueller?
Exactly.
Bueller?
Fry. You are doing a retinectomy or doing something in the periphery, and all of a sudden you hit the choroid, and now it's bleeding. What do you do?
So anytime you get bleeding during a case, TRD repairs or retinectomies, I think you really have to pause for a moment, because if you don't control the bleeding, it's going to make the rest of your case so much more difficult. So I think doing a good job of managing bleeding during the case is important. And so obviously diathermy, making sure that you sort of pop the pressure up, and then even you can try applying pressure with the tip of the cutter. If it's a case where you really don't feel comfortable pumping the pressure up, you can try to apply sort of a manual tamponade. But these cases can be really hard, and sometimes you have to really apply a fair amount of diathermy, especially if you've damaged the choroid. The other thing is, and this is a J trick that I learned, is lowering the pressure at the end of the case to make sure that you don't have any residual oozers out in the periphery. So after you're sort of done, things are looking good, lower your pressure down to like 10 and give it a couple seconds just to make sure that you're not still oozing, because that'll make you a lot happier on post-op day one if you don't have an eye filled with blood.
Yeah, and that's especially helpful for like a diabetic type case where you might have these micro oozers. And then let's say, Sarah, the other pearl I would say, remember the diathermy tip is sharp. So the one key, if you're going to diathermize the RP or choroid, is you want to keep penetrating deeper and deeper and causing more bleeding. So to kind of know your depth as you're diathermizing, so you're not traumatizing those vessels more. Sriji, let's say it just keeps bleeding. You kick the pressure to 60 and now it's still pumping blood. What do you do next?
So one of the things that I found helpful, especially if there's a lot of bleeding, it can definitely obstruct your view, is if you go to air at that point, you to quote the fluid space on the bottom and then get rid of that blood, and then it'll help prevent this from obstructing your view, and then you can try and attack again with the diathermy and see if you can isolate where exactly the bleeder is coming from.
That's a great point. Two other pearls that I heard in conference. One reason air works better, it has a higher surface tension, obviously, than fluid, so it helps kind of with that manual pressure on the bleeder. PFO has the highest surface tension, so I've heard a posterior bleeder, if it's bleeding a lot, you can put PFO down. That will help tamponade. And Dan Chow shared the pearl before that if you do have something that's bleeding a lot, you can kick the pressure up and come out of the eye completely, because sometimes when you have instruments through the valves in the eye, you're opening the valves, you're not maintaining that high pressure. Sometimes coming out of the eye completely, letting the pressure work for a minute or two to tamponade, then going back in. Next one, Sriji, you have a
I like that idea. It's sort of like you take a minute, take a few deep breaths, then go back in.
It's good mentally too, yeah, and for your heart rate. And
Dan Chow, brilliant. Very zen.
Sriji, you have a large break or giant retinal tear or retinectomy that slips during your fluid air exchange. Why did this happen, and what do you do next?
Yeah, so, you know, I'll see this from time to time. The reason I've seen this happen is when the FAX is happening too quickly. So if, you know, you're trying to remove the fluid too fast at the fluid cuff, you can definitely get this type of slippage. So the first and foremost, you want to make sure that you go nice and slow with the FAX to try and keep the retina in place and try and prevent any fluid from going underneath or pushing the air pushing the retina posteriorly. When this happens, reassess, see where you may have gone wrong. I'll usually go back to fluid. If the situation where it keeps on happening, you may need to consider doing something almost like a silicone oil PFO exchange and seeing if that can help prevent the slippage if you may be getting it with just going straight to air.
Good points. Sarah, anything to add?
I would say I agree completely. I think the real golden nugget is going really slow with your fluid air exchange. Like, it should take you 5 to 10 minutes, like painfully slow. If most of these cases you're using PFO, so usually what I'll do is I'll bring the fluid air exchange down to the PFO, then do my laser. I'll even come out of the eye and just look at the clock for a little while. Really give a lot of time for the fluid to come down out of the ciliary body and all of that to make sure that just because you think it's dry, it's probably not dry. So just give it lots of time. And then the second thing is, a lot of times these cases, I'll do a scleral buckle, kind of depending on what the case is. So you also might want to consider loosening the buckle. Mm-hmm.
Good points. And Sunir Garg was one of my attendees, used to say he would actually look at the clock for and time 5 minutes. It's the longest 5 minutes you'll ever experience. Too high a buckle, it depends on the location of a GRT or a large break. If it's completely supported by the buckle, it's not as big an issue. But if it's kind of on the edge of the buckle, then you can fish mouth it open and cause more slippage with the high buckle. And then the other thing is, if it does slip, Sriji mentioned going back to fluid and restarting. I think there are cases where a little bit of slippage is tolerable, but if there's significant slippage, you're only fooling yourself by trying to just leave it in some of these cases. And I think the thing I've tried when I was a fellow, which does not work, is you can't just like make a retinotomy in the area of the slipped retina and try to drain that flat. Usually if it's that large a break, the slippage won't be appropriate. Now, if it was a smaller break and the retinotomy works, then maybe slippage was never as big an issue as you thought. But for the really large DRTs with slippage, that doesn't necessarily work, despite my best efforts. Unless it works for someone out there.
Has not for me.
The case is almost over. So it slipped. We went back to fluid. Now we're under. Well, actually, I had this happen once to me in the same case. It was not fun. And it was on the patient's birthday, so it was not fun either. So we had slippage. We went back. We did the PFO. We're putting oil. And all of a sudden, the oil is in the anterior chamber. Why did this happen? And how can I prevent it? And then what do I do now that I have oil in my AC?
So I think this one's me. So I would say silicone oil in the AC is a very annoying thing to happen in a case. And so the best way to treat it is to prevent it. And that's really watching your fill, using a needle to actually make sure that you're not overfilling. Go slow at the end. If you have more superior pathology, considering doing a slight underfill. If you're using hooks, make sure you're taking out the hooks before then. because otherwise you will, as you take out the hooks, you're going to flatten your AC and the oil is going to pop up front. The other thing sometimes what I'll do is I'll put Helon into the AC to sort of act as an AC maintainer and prevent the oil from coming forward. When I do that, I usually will also give the patient some Diamox right after and then for a short course for 3 days. If you do get oil in the AC, or you know, if it's an aphakic patient or a patient with an ACIOL, you want to make sure, obviously, that you always have an inferior PI. Sometimes you get oil in the AC, and your choice is either to go back to square one, take the oil out, to really try to get the oil out of the anterior chamber. Just by trying to burp it out of the AC, you'll just keep drawing more oil forward and forward. Depending on the case, usually I don't think it's worth the trauma of trying to go in and remove that oil. And so a lot of times I'll just be pretty aggressive about having the patient position and just sort of leave it there, unfortunately, if it's not too much oil.
We are running short of time, Sriji, so I'm just going to make a quick comment and then go to the number 10. That was great, Sarah. I would say if you don't forget to decrease your air pressure as you're infusing the oil at the very end, then sometimes that will help push some oil forward in the anterior chamber. And then Sarah mentioned hooks. Anything that causes negative pressure, so a para or a wound that's leaking in the front, anything that was not, you should hydrate that before you go to air or before you go to oil, because that's going to draw things forward to the AC. Sriji, we're almost done here. I got to run to the OR. This has been 10 complications in 20 minutes. Last complication. Fellows closing for you. You walk, you're just looking through the side scope, and they pass a suture, and you notice a change in the red reflex and some hemorrhage, some heme kind of gushing from the sclerotomy. What happened, and now what do you do?
Yeah. So it was most likely a deep patch, a hard to reassess and see how much the bleeding is. Is it just a small little bleed, and it's stopping? Or are we running into a huge issue? I've had to put the sclerotomies back in and reassess and almost start from square one. So it's definitely not something that you want to ignore completely. If it's a small bleed and the eye is appropriately pressurized, you should be good and it can clear. But it's definitely something I would not just brush it off, is what I would say. You need to kind of reassess. See.
Sriji?
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm so sorry. The tornadoes here kind of knocked out the cell service a little bit.
There are tornadoes?
Oh, man.
Oh, wow. Well,
yeah, Nashville got hit with tornadoes again because we were wanting for problems.
That was.
I feel like you know it's bad when that doesn't even make the news.
With Sriji Patel and Sarah Reed, if my voice just changed, it's because I have my N95 on. I got to run to the OR. Guys, thanks so much for doing this. This was great. If people like it, we'll do it again. Take care, guys.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye, Jay.
Bye, guys.
Bye, Sriji. Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior podcast episodes found on our website, retinapodcast.com, RETINAPodcast.com. All 242 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. In addition, you can find our blog, and you can find links to subscribe and get updates on the most recent episodes. You can also subscribe on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at RetinaPodcast. Or you can subscribe in the podcast application on your mobile device. You can reach us directly by emailing us at retinapodcast.com, that's RETINAPodcast.com, or clicking on the contact us link on our website. This episode came from feedback. If you have feedback on episodes you'd like to hear about, topics you'd like to hear about, or any sort of general feedback, please reach out, and we always appreciate those positive reviews people write in the Apple and Android store. Thanks to Dr. Reed and Dr. Patel for joining me for this complications discussion. Thank you to Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benicasa for putting together this episode. And thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.